marriage. And I think dating and marriage isn't spoken enough about enough with the boys and girls. Maybe it's spoken about a lot with the girls, but not enough with the boys. And marriage has only become more challenging. We need to be doing more to make sure that people are ready. Particularly the issue of getting along and marital harmony is such a challenge today. And because it's not spoken about, people are surprised when there are problems. And then they're disappointed that they're having problems. And most importantly, they don't know what to do about it. And that's a terrible problem, because at least we can prepare people with a readiness and anticipation that marriage is not simple. And by speaking about these things, we're really helping the future of Klal Yisrael, because the Jewish home is where it all begins. Because people are looking for answers and information about this, and because it's not spoken enough in Torah communities and from a Torah perspective, people look online and to how-to books on how to live our lives as married couples. And I'm not putting down those books, but there's no reason to assume that the things you see in secular literature are the Torah perspective on marriage. And just as we have a Torah perspective on how to raise children and a Torah perspective on how to live our lives properly, the Torah also has a perspective on how to manage and how to live as husband and wife. We just have to cull the information, especially how it applies to the realities we face today, and share it with people. And this shiur is part of that series of topics based on Torah perspective, the advice we can find about how to handle arguments in marriage and manage them when they occur. Now, to clarify again, a lot of the information out there in secular literature is excellent. We just have to make sure, using our Torah sources, that it really is the Torah perspective on how to deal with the challenges we face. So you'll see many secular quotes here, but they're things that resonate with the Torah perspective on these issues. Without further ado, the Hebrew language is a very small language, very small number of words, but there's a lot of words used to describe relationships. For example, the famous bracha, Asher bara sasam v'simcha chatan v'kala, Gila, Rina, Ditza, V'chedva, Ava, V'yachva, V'shalom, V'reyot. Look how many words to describe the relationship between two people. All of them girls' names, by the way. You wonder why a boy couldn't be named, you know, happiness and glee and friendly in a relationship. Maybe because the word Ditza, if we use the masculine Ditz, it wouldn't fit so well with a boy. But in any case, all of them girls' names. You see how important it is. And we see this particularly from the laws, none other than the issue of Sota, where there's a question of infidelity within a marriage, and it's a unique situation, the only case in the Torah where the Torah mandates a miracle to clarify if the person has been true or guilty. There are a lot of cases where we have a suffix, where we have a doubt, but we never mix water, have the questioned party drink it, and have them blow up if they were guilty. Why is it so important to clarify this issue? So the Ramban, second source, page 1, he says, V'hinei ein b'chol mishpatei ha-Torah, davar toli b'neis, zulati ha-inyan hazeh. This is unique in the Torah, and he gives two suggestions as to why. The first is, as a deterrent, if people know that this will happen to them, if they're suspected of monkey business, people will avoid it. And then he says, to make sure we have a clear understanding of our lineage. If we don't know who's born to whom, it's a major problem. But I believe there's more here, and I think you see there's more here from three interesting aspects of the laws of Sota. The first is the bracha that the woman, if she's innocent, receives. Again, the woman definitely did something inappropriate. She's alone in a room with another man for the second time and the third time. It's inappropriate. So it could be she's not guilty. But why should she receive a bracha if she's not guilty? She should be let off, but not receive a bracha. The second interesting feature of Sota, if we look in the Psukim, the fourth source here, Bamidbar Perikei, is that the Torah mandates the woman drinking not when she's objectively suspected, but when the husband is jealous. Seven times the word kinah appears. Only if the husband is bothered does the woman need to drink. Why is it that way? The third question, which brings us to the answer, is this. If God wanted to create a miracle to clarify if the woman was innocent or guilty, He could have done it without erasing his own name. Why does the Torah mandate that God's name be erased in order to clarify this? The miracle wouldn't have worked with dirt in water. You need God's name to be erased. The Gemara in Chulin, I believe, answers all of these questions when it says, Gadol shalom shebein ish liishto. The peace between husband and wife is so great. Shehari amra Torah shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu shenichtav b'kdusha yimach ha'alamayim. The reason God tells us to erase his name is to show us how important this is. We should understand that Shalom Bayis is so important that God wants to put his name and its erasure on the line. The issue here is not an objective question. The issue is that the relationship between husband and wife is broken down. There's a jealousy, there's a suspicion. You cannot build a home this way. And that's why if the woman is innocent, we can't just send her home without a bracha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do something to restore the relationship between them. And the hope is that the bracha will help them take it to the next level. The laws of Sota are really about Shalom Bayit. And if you look at the end of page 1, the Chinuch writes that the purpose of this miracle is l'hotzi mitoch levavenu achshad v'nishotenu, to remove from our hearts our suspicion of one another. In another part of the series of Shiurim, I speak about how marriage begins with the Tnayim, before the Ksuva. And in the Tnayim we say, both sides commit not to hide things from each other, to be able to trust each other. Trust is the beginning of a relationship, and that's what the laws of Sota are meant to restore. And the Chinuch continues in the second paragraph and says, v'mitoch kach, through this, through the removing of suspicion, we can have love and peace and harmony and holy children. In order for a family to be raised properly, the cell bond has to be strong. And that's what the laws of Sota come to teach us. If you look at page 2, we see a very powerful story where Chazal applied this idea. There was a woman who came home one day late. She was at the shir of Rabbi Yehuda, the Tana. She came home late. And her husband was upset. She prepared dinner. And he said, why don't you go feed it to Rabbi Yehuda? That's what he said. So the woman went to Rabbi Yehuda. And so my husband said, I should give it to you. It was a little bit of an insult. So Rabbi Yehuda said, I'd be glad to eat it. The Talmidim said, what kind of chutzpah? Why did you do this? And he said, Kal v'chomer. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu is willing to erase his name to make peace between husband and wife, I'm willing to be belittled and eat the food. And we see this idea in a very powerful tshuva of the great Rav Avadi Yosef in the last generation of how important Shalom Bayit is within the Jewish people. There was a woman, a Sephardic woman, who had her first child, a boy, Mazel Tov. They made the Brit. Rav Avadi attended. They then began preparing for the Pidgin event. The woman sent a message to Rav Avadi, I need to see you urgently. Got a message like that. Rav Avadi welcomed the woman in. He said, what's the problem? She said, I'm a balas tshuva. Rav Avadi immediately knew what it was. Before I was from, I had a pregnancy that I aborted. This is not my first pregnancy. We should not be making a pidgin aven. Rav Avadi said, make the pidgin aven. But she said, my husband will make a bracha levatala. That God is willing to erase his name for there to be peace between husband and wife. There's a mistake made in our tzibur, sadly because of what's propagated on Facebook. Chazal and Rabbanim are not sensitive to harmony and peace and men and women, etc. We take halacha very seriously. We're also very sensitive, and that's what we see here. Just to add one last point, and we really have to get to the ikkar of the shir. But in the second part of page 2, Avot Rabbi Nassan says, anyone who makes peace between husband and wife, it's as if he makes peace for the whole Jewish people. And I think the explanation of this is that the cell within a home, when husband and wife live in harmony, both of them are able to live in better harmony with everyone around them. It begins in the home. The harmony in that core relationship. And we see the impact of this in the Gemara in Sukkah Daf Nun Gimel, which says when David HaMelech was digging the foundations for the Beit HaMikdash, the waters from below wanted to rise up and flood the world. And what they did was they threw the name of God into the water to put them back down, and the name of God was erased. And the message was, we learned from Sota that God erases his world, his name, to keep peace in the world. Starts with a couple, continues to the world as a whole. The bottom of page 2, Rav Kook, has a very powerful piece, which we don't have enough time to read, but I recommend people looking at it. And he says, the trust within family is the automatic result that comes from the great belief in love. When people are brought together by love, it generates a natural trust. But Rav Kook says, when that trust is broken, when there's mi'ilah, it undermines people's faith not only in their spouse but in the world around them too. And when people lack the faith, trust, and love with their own spouse, they can't show those emotions to the world around them. And that's when the social pact breaks down. Says Rav Kook, the world is looking to reattain that trust and love and that ability to trust and love each other and be able to build within nations and between nations. Or in other words, people naturally trust each other. Because, and after we're raised in New York, we learn not to trust each other. But we naturally want to trust each other. And if we could, it would generate a world that would function better. And it starts with the ability of husband and wife to trust each other. And that is the backdrop for this shiur. As I mentioned, it's a shiur that's basically number 16 in a series. But let's try and focus in on the issues that we're relating to today. Point number one, page 3. People need realistic expectations. One of the most major reasons why there are problems in marriage is because people enter into marriage with unrealistic expectations. Let's start number one. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin writes that God is great because when a person mints a coin or coins, they all come out the same way. God creates people and they all come out differently. That's why the Tosefta says when you see a mass gathering of people, you're supposed to bless God for his wisdom because they don't look the same and they don't think the same. God is the only one who can create millions and millions and millions and billions of people who are all different. We know it physically, fingerprints, but that's really indicative of what's going on the inside. The Yerushalmi says, "Kishem she'ein partsufin domin zelaze." Just like we don't look the same, "Kach ein da'atan domin zelaze." We don't think the same. I always say, if you were walking down the street and met someone who looked exactly like you, assuming you don't have an identical twin, you would panic. How could it be? But why is it that we expect people to think the same way? And this we see is something we make a bracha on. We make a bracha that God made us all different, all unique. We're going to see in a few parashiyot when Moshe asks God to appoint a replacement for him, he says, Bamidbar Perachav Zayin, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Yifkod Hashem Elokei HaRucho L'Kol Basar Ish Al Ha'eda. God, the God of the spirits of all men, should appoint someone to lead the Jewish people. The Medrash Tanchuma explains why Moshe refers to God this way. He goes, you created all these people. You know how different they are. You know how challenging leading them is. Make sure to appoint someone who can deal with that differentness. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim at the bottom of page 3 speaks about how human beings don't by chance think differently than each other. It's built in that we're going to think differently than each other. It's impossible to not think differently than each other. Or continuing on page 4, as Cook writes, when life flourishes, when people truly realize who they're meant to be, it's impossible for them to agree with each other. Or in other words, agreement is because people haven't fully fleshed themselves out yet. Rav Nachman Mibreslov has a very powerful piece which begins with the words, Kol ha'olam mali machloket. The whole world is full of disagreement. Now he doesn't mean fighting. He means differentness. He says, every home, every block, every neighborhood, every city, every nation, between nations, everyone is different. We knew this without Rav Nachman. But we learned from Rav Nachman that that's what's built into the system. And that's the potential for richness when we can bring together differentness and harmony. But the first step is to be able to embrace it. So this is number one, to realize and expect that two people who are married to each other are not going to be the same. And they're not going to look at things the same way. Point number two, bottom of page 4. There's a very famous statement of the Baal Shem Tov on the pasuk, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Such a challenging thing. How can we love other people like ourselves? The Baal Shem Tov said, love other people like yourself. You're imperfect. You love yourself. Love other people. They're also imperfect. The realization, expectation, acceptance of imperfection. Ben Tillett writes in the bottom of page 4, God help the man who won't marry until he finds a perfect woman. And God help him still more if he finds her. If a person thinks they have found the perfect spouse, the expectations of what they're going to expect are impossible to live with. So number one, to realize that people are different and we're going to be different even if we love each other. Number two, everyone is imperfect. We're all going to live with people who are imperfect. Number three, stress. I'm going to let people in on a secret on the condition nobody steals it from me, okay? Rabbi Dr. Abraham Chorsky has a lot of wonderful books. I like his book, The First Year of Marriage. I bought 30 copies. I give it out to each of the chatanim of the yeshiva. I'm only willing to share that on the condition that nobody starts buying up the books and giving them get to the wedding before me and flipping copies out. And you'll see a number of quotes from there. People get nervous when their lives are full of stress. He says, there's no such thing as a stress-free existence, and there's no way one can have a stress-free marriage. Furthermore, stress has been given unwarranted bad press. Stress is what makes the world go round. Without stress, to get us moving, we would hibernate all year round like bears in the winter. It is when stress is excessive, when stress becomes distress, that's when it becomes destructive, affecting a person physically as well as emotionally. I think one can say the same thing about being intense versus tense. People are meant to work. People are meant to be intense. People are meant to work with pressure. That's why we work. And the notion that there'll be stress is part of what helps people grow. The expectation that there won't be is a lot of where the problems begin. Last but not least in this section, number 4. It is clear from couples' research that conflict is definitely necessary for a relationship, which is a comforting thought. A lack of conflict means that you are not dealing with issues that matter and important concerns are kept under wraps. Keeping everything buried has poor predictive value for a relationship. So, we expect that there's going to be difference. We expect that the person we're married to is imperfect. We know that life includes stress and between any two people who need to interact with each other, and we know that there are going to be disagreements. The question is, what do we do about it? The first thing is the willingness and interest to solve problems. It sounds simple, but it isn't always there. We have to know that it's important to us to solve problems. Last parrot, page number 6. Two independent persons forming a way of life together eventually run into power struggles and must learn to adjust to each other's ways. The intensity and turmoil of this stage varies amongst couples, but almost every couple engages in the struggle. Successful passage through this stage enables each partner to say, okay, I'm willing to admit that my romance with a perfect partner is an illusion. However, I'm still fascinated with the mystery of who you are, and I'm willing to pursue romance with you and journey together towards a more mature love. It's that realization that there are built-in imperfections, there are built-in tensions and frustrations, but we want to make it work together. Many people have pointed out something about coming to grips in terms with the reality of marriage, which means remembering that we have 3 and only 3 options, and we forget it. People can get divorced, they can live in a loveless marriage, or they can choose to love the person they're with. And recognizing that and understanding it truly is the beginning of solving problems. Understanding that there are no other options. There's no option 4. And that if you don't work on option 3, the only other options are options 1 and 2. The point is realizing why it should be critical for us to solve problems. Rabbi Chorsky, in the same book, I'm going to look at the second part in the footnote, he talks about why there's such a challenge. Why is it such a problem today? One of the side effects of modern life has been that patience and willingness to work things out are often in short supply. Technology has eroded our tolerance for endurance. Jet planes, fax machines, instant foods, and microwave ovens have habituated us to want and expect results immediately. Willingness to repair relationships has suffered from the disposable age. In my youth, the fountain pen was a valued object. The Schaefer pen I received from my bar mitzvah was a treasured companion for 20 years, and I felt an attachment to it. Today's cheap ballpoint pens are throwaways. The lack of meaningful attachments to objects, which would warrant repairing and keeping them, has had an influence in human relationships as well. The alarming incidence of divorce may be due in no small part to an attitude of, don't bother trying to fix a relationship, just discard it and get a new one. The point is for people to internalize what the options are in an age where we're not used to making things work, where we're not used to holding on to things, and understanding the importance of doing so. And I think where this is supposed to come from, if we look at page 7, is the model of marriage, the beautiful model of marriage we see by Yitzchak and Rivka. Everyone remembers Yitzchak and Rivka are the first couple we're told about how they met and the whole process of them building the relationship. Avram and Sarah, for example, were just told they got married. We don't know anything before, anything after. Noach and his wife, we don't know. But Yitzchak and Rivka, we do. They're married, and they can't have a child. And we're told on the top of page 7 that Yitzchak davens lenochach ishto ki akarahi. Lenochach ishto. Literally opposite his wife. Everyone knows Rashi's pshat. He was in one corner, his wife was in the opposite corner. What is the significance of them davening that way? The Chizkuni explains that he davened opposite her because he was davening for her. The Radak elaborates on this. Yitzchak knew he would have a child because God had promised Avram, ki bi Yitzchak yikar lechazara. He knew he would have a child. The question is whether it would be from Rivka. And he knew that his father Avram, before having a child from his loved wife Sarah, had a child through Hagar. He didn't want that. And the Radak explains what he was saying to God was, I want my children to be from this woman. Or in the language of the Medrash, next source, fifth source, page 7, each of them was davening, any children I have, please let them be from this spouse. What that's expressive of is the recognition, is the feeling, the move from I to we. I no longer see myself as a separate entity. I see myself as connected in a way that whatever I get, I want to be together with this person. That shift in understanding is part of where the interest in solving problems comes from. The realization that we are part of a whole that won't be separated. And the source for this goes back to the creation of the world. When man and woman were created, God blessed them and called them together Adam. Vayikra et shmam Adam. Rabbi Elazar says in the Gemara in Yevamos, "Kol Adam she'ein lo isha eino Adam." A person without a wife is not single. He's not a person. Or in other words, a person is really when two people come together. That is living life as one. And of course, the source of this is that man initially had woman as part of him, and then they were separated. When they returned to each other, they now become a person. If a person sees himself as only a person together with their spouse, it changes the whole perspective of how you see getting along. The Gemara, the Medrash, in the bottom of page 7, talks about how so many other aspects of life are connected and dependent upon marriage. And this explains on page 8 the famous idea that everyone knows from the Zohar, and I'm going to elaborate a little bit on the idea. The Zohar says that a soul comes down to the world and splits between two people. When people get married, they become one body and one soul because they really come from the same source. The Akedas Yitzchak explains beautifully, beautifully, why did Avram have to suffer so much to bury Sarah in Hebron? Why are we told about this? Why is it important? The Akedas Yitzchak says to see how Avram viewed his marriage. He didn't want to be separated during his life, and he didn't want to be separated in his death. Meaning, when people say, till death do us part, Avram felt, even after death, I don't want to part. V'lo ratza sheyafrid ha-mavis b'neihem, kimo shelo yirtze ha-adam l'chalek v'likaver b'shnei mekomos. Just like a person wouldn't want their body buried in two places, Avram didn't want to be buried separately from Sarah. Everyone knows the famous story along these lines about Rabbi Aryeh Levine, whose wife had a pain in her foot, and they went together to the doctor, whereupon the doctor asked, "What can I do for you?" And Rabbi Levine answered in all sincerity, "Doctor, my wife's leg is hurting us." This understanding and seeing, the ability to transcend feeling, is very powerful. There was a great gadol in Eretz Yisrael who recently passed away, Rav Yaakov Edelstein. Sivan Rav Meir wrote a book about him. A chance for me to mention my other hat, World Mizrahi, that she's coming, Emir Tashem, to America as a shlicha for the next year to speak about Israel, and people should enjoy. She'll be living in this area in Woodmere, Emir Tashem. In any case, in that book called Sulam Yaakov, she speaks about Rav Yaakov Edelstein when his wife was in the hospital undergoing surgery. He was already an old man, and he insisted on sleeping on the floor. And they asked him why he's sleeping on the floor. He said, "If my wife is in pain, how can I sleep in bed and not feel the pain she's feeling?" Meaning that feeling of being one unit, of wanting to make sure we're one unit, is an important part of what generates people having the motivation to solve problems. Last but not least, regarding this idea, there's a very famous Rashi regarding the mirrors that the women donated for the Kior. They brought in their perfume mirrors. They're makeup mirrors. And Moshe didn't want to take them because they were makeup mirrors that were being used for physical relations. And God said there's nothing more beautiful than the mirrors people use to beautify themselves for one another. And in fact, God specified when the Jews were in Egypt and the men didn't want to bring children into the world, they were tired, they were depressed. The women would go out to the fields, hold those mirrors up in front of the two of them. My wife Shani likes to call it the first selfie. Hold the mirror up in front of the two of them. Let's remind ourselves of our relationship with each other. That's what a wedding picture is. You see that picture, you look at yourself in that perspective of being part of a whole. Or as Rabbi Chorsky writes in that book, "I heard a man say, my wife and I used to fight a great deal. Of course, I did not want to lose a fight, but I realized that if I won, it meant that she lost. I did not want to be married to a loser. So we stopped fighting and began discussing instead." It's the interest in solving problems because we see ourselves as connected to one another. Okay, so what do we do in situations of fighting? I want to talk about two things on page 9. It's under the title of compromise, but there are really two things here. The first is working on ourselves. The very first thing newlyweds should know is that they must undergo some change and that changing a pattern of behavior may be difficult. It is also very important to know that the only person you can change is yourself. This line is one that takes many people many years to learn, and at great cost. It's also very important to know that the only person you can change is yourself. You cannot change another person. Hopefully, when you make changes in yourself, your partner will likewise make some changes. The false assumption, "I can change him or her," is the source of much misery. Keep this in mind. What you see is what you get. Of course, people can change, but only when they want to change. You cannot make a person change. You can change how you respond, and if you change your response, your spouse may decide to make a change too. Most importantly, your changes should and cannot be based on your partner making changes. So part of marriage is the understanding that we need to grow because we're living with another person, and how we interact with that person is important. But it means us changing as opposed to us demanding change. The next thing is when change isn't possible, how we compromise. And of course, everybody knows the famous Dvar Torah about the mezuzah, right? There's a machlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, whether a mezuzah should be placed vertically or horizontally. We put it on a slant to make a pshara between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, and it's a beautiful symbolism that when we enter into a home, the first thing we see is that compromise of how the mezuzah is placed. Or Dr. Abraham Chorsky writes in the footnote in the parentheses, at Hasidic weddings, it's customary to have a Rebbe Rav Melech dance. The dance is said to have originated with the Hasidic master Rav Elimelech Milozhinsk. People pair up and several pairs dance towards each other. When they meet, each pair raises their arms to form an arch, and the other bows down, dancing under the arch. On meeting the next pair, the pair that bowed and danced under the arch now raises their arms to form an arch, and the oncoming pair now bows and goes under the arch. With multiple pairs, the dance is very graceful. If one pair fails to raise their arms at the proper time, or a pair fails to bow when it is their turn, the two pairs collide. The message is that, in order to avoid collision, sometimes you are the one who yields, and sometimes it's the other partner who yields. Now, figuring out who's supposed to raise their arms and bend their arms at each moment is challenging, but the understanding that each one needs to is very important. So basically, this shiur has been about trying to avoid argument. When I first planned the shiur, I planned to address avoiding argument and managing arguments. And I just saw there was so much to speak about regarding avoiding arguments that I wouldn't be able to get to properly dealing with managing arguments. But I don't want to leave people without anything said about that, or else people go to the organizers and get upset that the titles don't reflect the shiur. So I want to say a few words about managing arguments, but I want it to be clear that there's a lot more to say about it, and maybe in the future. Rebbe Zeira was asked by his Talmid in page 10, what led to you living a long life? And he said, Miyamai lo hikbadati b'toch beiti. I never got upset about things going on in my home. And you can understand very well what the chiddush in that was, that a person didn't get upset about what was going on at home. And you can understand how that would lead to living a long life, because if a person avoids getting upset at home, they're avoiding a huge amount of stress, frustration, and tension in their lives. So this is a very hard thing to imagine someone being able to accomplish. But the notion of trying to strive for it as much as possible is very important. The Rambam summarizes this and says, when he talks about the relationship between husband and wife, that there shouldn't be intimidation, there should be speak benachas, without frustration, without anger. And again, these things are very hard, but to try. And the significance of this, we see the challenge and significance in the Gemara Chulin Daf Beis Ches, where Rabbi Eloi tells us, Ein ha'olam mitkayim, ela b'shvil mi sheboli misatzmo b'shas meriva. The world only exists because of the people who control themselves at a time of fighting. You can understand why this would be a great zchut, and you can understand why this would help the world be able to exist. People's ability to control themselves at the moments of anger and frustration are critical to how we handle disagreement. Continuing a piece I quoted earlier that talks about how important conflict is for relationships, the fifth line, the piece continues. The question, though, is, how do we have these arguments? The initial conversation will probably not go too well, and turning it into a marathon can make things even worse. Weil suggests taking a time out or exiting the dispute can be helpful. That doesn't mean we go into stonewalling, but rather coming up with a time when the issue will be revisited. To try, when we have disagreements, to keep them from turning into a fight. Keep them from turning into more than just the disagreement. And we know that love and hate are flip sides of each other. We see it, number two, the brachot, in the beginning of Parshas Pechukose, when God says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, if you follow my mitzvot, V'natati mishkani betochachem, I'll place my sanctuary amongst you, V'lo tigal nafshi etchem, and I won't be disgusted with you. What a strange way of describing love. It already hints to the fact that when love breaks down, it can turn into the worst disgust and hate. And here we have to be careful when there are disagreements, and there will be, to not allow them to spiral into emotional conflict. Or, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, there was a person who said, when I'm in love with my spouse, the two of us can sleep together on the pin of a sword, on the top of a sword. But when we're frustrated with each other, a bed that's 60 garmidim isn't enough for us. And the point is to not allow ourselves to get to the point of disgust with each other. We married each other. We appreciate each other. We see ourselves as one unit. We know that our choice is a loveless life or a life full of love. We're disagreeing. We're frustrated. We're angry. It bothers us. We should disagree. We should even disagree strongly. But we shouldn't allow it to spiral into fraying of the relationship. That's one of the major challenges of managing disagreements. Last point, page 11. Solving disagreements. And as I said, there's a lot more to say about the second part, maybe next year. Solving disagreements. There's a very strange Yerushalmi in Nedarim that one of the famous Rebbetzins of Israel, Yamima Mizrahi, for those who know her, has a beautiful spin on it, which I'd like to share with you. The Mishnah Nedarim is speaking about vows, people who make vows about each other. One of them is a woman who says, the sky is between the two of us. And what she means is, I don't want to have anything to do with you. The sky is endless. The sky is in between the two of us. So the Yerushalmi says, the Mishnah says, what happens if she says that? Yasu derech bakosha. They should find the way of requesting each other. What does that mean? Rav Huna writes in the Yerushalmi, Yasu suda v'hein mitraglim lavo derech suda. They should have a meal with each other. Come together with each other and find the way to come back together. Or in Yomima Mizrahi's words, a person who feels that the sky separates between the two of them should have a meal together with each other and bridge the gap. Meaning, sometimes when there's a disagreement, it's just there. It's just there, and it's there until someone bridges it. And of course you can't bridge it because I'm not going to be the one to bridge it. But in the end, it's we who pay the price when we don't. The point is to find the way to step back. There's a Gemara in Nedarim, which I didn't have a chance to include in the Makoros. She talks about one of the Amoraim whose wife made him miserable. Talks about what she used to do to him. It seems she was trying to make him miserable. He said everywhere he walked, he would look for gifts to buy for her. Everything he found that was nice, he would buy the gift and bring it to her. The point is he was looking for ways to show that even though she was angry with him, he was trying to bridge the gap. And of course, going out to eat is a very important thing. I think in today's world, couples should try at least once a week to go out together privately, not with the family, not with anyone else, just going out together. It's a good expression, a good venting, and it's a healthy way of creating a mechanism that forces bridging gaps. Because when you're together and enjoying together, you can't be separate from one another.
With no cell phone.
Yeah, I guess so, right? Let's end with one last point, and again, as I mentioned, there's a lot more to say. The deleterious effects on oneself of bearing a resentment in a marriage relationship are further compounded by the consequences of the discord it may cause between husband and wife. Therefore, it is important to learn to forgive one another and to forgive promptly. In any way one spouse has offended the other, a quick apology is in order. An excellent rule in marriage, as well as in other relationships, is never defend the mistake. When you apologize for something, be sincere, not manipulative. I said I was sorry already. Why can't you put it behind you and move on? Just forget it now. That is hardly a genuine apology. Similarly, I'm sorry for what I said, but you have to understand that it was under a lot of stress. That's making excuses and avoiding responsibility. A more meaningful statement is, I'm sorry. It was wrong for me to say something hurtful to you when I was stressed. And that really is the question. I think married couples need to ask themselves whether it's kedai for them, whether it's worthwhile to be angry at each other. Now, we don't ask that question before we get angry with each other. But the question is to try and remember as early a stage as possible to ask whether it's really worth it. And it's hard when we're emotional and frustrated and hurt by the person we love the most to ask ourselves the practical question of whether it's worth it. But generally, it's not. Meaning, we disagree not because it's worth it. We disagree because we disagree. You can't avoid disagreement. The question is what we do when we disagree. Trying to avoid it from turning into a fight and trying to solve the fight, trying to keep the fight from turning into a situation of hatred and despise, and trying to solve it and return it to the real emotions we have for each other. There's nothing more important, and hopefully we'll learn a little bit how to make it better. My wife asked me how I'm giving such a shiur. I said, any married person has a lot of experience with this. And the question is whether we learn from the experience how to do it better, and hopefully by sharing with you, I'll become a little better, we'll all become a little bit better, and the world will become a little bit better. Everyone should have an enjoyable day. Thank you.